Thank you so much to the Earl of Selborne and the Foundation and to Dougal, the CEO, and to all of you. The first observation I have is the extremely welcome range of people in this room, the expertise across government, business, civil society, academia. And that'll be one of the themes that comes through what I say again and again, is the importance of these groups really cross-referencing and working in a cross-disciplinary way together. So I'm delighted we've got the right group of very eminent people in the room. So thank you all so much for covering the most important topic in the world at the start of this important year on it. I'll just start with a very simple framing. I've attributed it to Christiana Figueres, but I'm sure others have used it, before getting to the third question, which is tonight's: is it achievable? Can we do the Paris Agreement? Can we limit global temperature? I've used the Paris Agreement formulation of 2 degrees and ideally to 1.5, but I will reference the IPCC report last year, which really helped push us more towards the 1.5 conversation. But this is the formulation we've got. But before I do point three about is it achievable, let me just quickly touch on the first two. So do we need to do this on climate change? Is it necessary? Yes. Is it desirable? Do we want to do it? That's very important politically. Is it good for us? Yes. Is it achievable? And that's the really, really tough one where I say yes, but. I won't go too much into the science, but I did just want to give us the opening perspective about those projections. The black line is where we are already at a degree of warming. And down here was really where the IPCC did its work. It really showed us that 2 degrees is a pretty frightening place to be. So 2 degrees, the statistic I've found has really resonated around the world in my travels. Many of you know, 1.5 degrees, we could perhaps save 20 or 30% of the world's coral. 2 degrees, 99% is gone. So you perhaps get a percent or less of the world's coral. So the difference between 1.5 and 2 came out very powerfully in the latest IPCC, while we are on course for 3 or 4 degrees. So I think the power of that report at the end of last year in resetting the perspective as to what we're on track for and where we need to get to was very effective. So congratulations and appreciation to all of those involved in that. Is tackling it necessary? So what does 2 degrees, 3 degrees, 4 degrees mean? I've just given you the corals example, but from the foreign policy perspective, and I'll come on to the economics, but even from the foreign policy perspective, this is now over a decade old, a wonderful piece of collaboration with the Met Office and our incredible ecosystem at the Walker and Tyndall Institutes and with the Foreign Office, just to give a smattering, and you don't need to be able to read the graphics, just to show just two things for me: how absolutely comprehensive the impacts are across the world in multiple, very different, but profoundly interconnected ways. Whether it's permafrost, Arctic, Antarctic, rainforests, Sahel, South Asia, monsoons. So across all of these issues around scarcity of water, soil qualities, resources, and so on, you cannot overstate the truly comprehensive global nature. This is a 4 degrees map. The second thing I was struck me about this was there are different ways of modeling this, but where you have a 4 degree world, you've got a 1 or 2 degree ocean, and you've got way over 10 degrees of change in many parts of the world. So when we talk about the extreme weather events that are increasingly hitting us, I think this is worth bearing in mind. We have no idea just how this raft of extreme weather events begin to interconnect as they intensify, become more frequent, and so on. We're beginning to get a feel for it at 1 degree. And interestingly, the Pacific Islands are pretty much at 1.5, and they're the ones that had Cyclone Winston that knocked out Fiji, who was just about to host the climate COP and couldn't because of an extreme weather event. And they're the ones that had Cyclone Pam, just as Tuvalu was about to host the Commonwealth heads who were going to discuss climate change. So that's the front line, and there are lots of other front lines. But is it necessary to tackle this? I hope in brief I've described why, and we can come on to this in the discussion if it's helpful. So I'll move on to the second prior, which is it desirable? Do we want to do this? and I'll get a little bit less technical and just give one of many. I mean, this is, what if it's a hoax and we create a better world for nothing? When you list the benefits of tackling this issue, it's extraordinary. From a societal point of view, preservation of our biodiversity, our rainforest, sustainability, green jobs. Green jobs are growing in some places at 10 times the rate of other jobs. If you want jobs, if you want skilled jobs, if you want a job in every district of America, and if you challenge the Republican governors in the Midwest to reduce their wind and solar subsidies, you hear pretty quickly how these create jobs in every district of America. Renewables, livable cities, clean water, healthy children. My children are in one of those schools that are at illegal levels of pollution in the streets of London. 4 million or 5 million people dying prematurely every year from air quality, a lot of it coal related. So there's a sort of extraordinary range of reasons to do this, and I'll come back to how that helps us. And let's just touch on a particular economic reason for doing it. This is an extrapolation of low carbon economic growth in the UK and projected UK GDP growth in the UK. So it's pretty extraordinary, and it's pretty clear the direction that we need to go. So coming on to the meat of the discussion on the achievability, the very, very difficult question. I'll just put up, again, without going into detail, perhaps one of the key slides of the IPCC report. And as you have population growth going up, resource use going up, economic prosperity and growth going up, there at 2020 is where we are on emissions of around 40, 50 billion tons of CO2 emissions a year. And you may have heard in the headlines around, you know, in a couple of years or thereabouts, we need to be peaking. And in the next 12 years, we've got to sort this out. Otherwise, the game could be up. And that's where, when you go on to 2030, you've got to, within a decade, have put pretty much every dollar and cent of investment globally into sustainable finance. You've got to have innovated. You've got to have tackled the big technological challenges and shown at scale commercially they're viable. And you've got to have got on a really savage downward trajectory to get close to a net zero position around the middle of the century. And then there's a huge amount here of forest growth and other ways of continuing to take carbon out or replenish the biodiversity of the ecosystem. So technically achievable, but the dramatic nature of the reductions and the way that that just drops in the next 2 to 5 years is very striking and powerful, I think. China accounts for half of the current growth, but is also accounting for a huge amount of the renewable solutions and other innovations. So it's a very interesting question that Professor Chie will be coming on to around some of the more challenging areas around the world as to how we tackle this. But the headline message is just how challenging it is, relating back to the earlier slides about just how catastrophic it is not to meet the challenge. Let me just take a UK example of is it achievable part two. We've seen the global picture of what needs to happen. Let me give an upbeat message in the area of energy. And apologies for those who know this story inside out, but the black line and what we've done to take coal out of our economy to that historic day nearly 2 years ago when we had zero coal in the electricity generation for the first time since 1882. And you can see how that happened. The building of solar, the offshore wind story in particular. And the offshore wind story really is one where I think we look at the regulatory policy, business innovation, scientific and university collaborations that led to a policy solution and an outcome where we are the biggest offshore wind producer in the world from a standing start, with offshore wind now at a unit cost less than new gas and significantly less than nuclear and hugely less than coal, especially if those fossil fuels really fully impute the pollution they cause. So there's a very positive story there around the energy sector. It needs to go a lot further, a lot faster, but globally, 80 or so percent of investments in energy are going into the cleaner stuff now. looking at the more difficult areas, Lord Deben's here, and the Climate Change Committee has played this critical role in saying, yes, but. So we have a clean energy strategy in the UK, which the committee has noted is very impressive, but only gets us around 60% of the way to getting us on track to meet our carbon budgets in 10 years' time. But the beauty of the historic and first ever Climate Change Act that the UK delivered, which Bryony was instrumental in and may reference, was it gives us that long-term certainty about what we need to do and how we need to go about doing it. And so we're very clear in the UK case that in energy we're on a reasonable track with a lot more to do. But when it comes to transportation, buildings, heat, cooling, agriculture and land use, and industrial processes that need the carbon capturing and ideally utilising as well as storing, we have huge steps to take. Others may debate what I'm about to say. I think I would say that the technology is there, it's known, it's just not at scale, and therefore the costs are not brought down as much as they could be, and it's not commercially in place in many, many respects. But so a mixed picture about the UK. I mean, the frightening thing now, though, is the UK has, and others have independently have said, one of the best, if not the best, frameworks and action plans and long-term strategies in the world. Yet we are in a very difficult place, a very challenging place to meet the fourth and fifth budgets and then to potentially go further. And as some of you know, it was a really, really important, a quietly important step last year when the government agreed to review the long-term target under the 2008 Climate Change Act on the 10th anniversary of that act and say to the Climate Change Committee, please tell us where we should be in 2050. Is it still 80% below? Or is it more? And I think it's unlikely that we won't see a more ambitious recommendation from the committee. We've also asked explicitly, though, about the net zero question. So the government's had to focus a lot on this whole range of issues in the last year or 18 months. There's been criticism, I think, over the last few years that the government hasn't been as focused. But I can tell you from sort of within the system, and some of my colleagues are in the room, it's been a quite remarkable period, year or 18 months or so. The industrial strategy with a clean green underpinning and set of grand challenges, the clean growth strategy, our leadership on zero emissions vehicles, the first summit to pull together the huge range of issues around that. It's not cars, it's storage, it's networks, it's data, it's digital, it's getting the energy off the sea and into vehicles, it's using vehicles as storage. Zero emissions was an area that we tried to really show some leadership on last year. Powering past coal was an alliance we established with Canada the year before, which was seen as the political high point of COP23, quote unquote, from The Guardian, who tend to be quite challenging on these things. And in between, we've had an extraordinary effort from the green finance community, who have come forward with a task force set of recommendations that the government will respond to with a green finance strategy in the weeks and months ahead. So there's an enormous amount going on, and we're only just sort of keeping pace with where we need to, with where we need to be, or perhaps not quite. So, as the Foreign Office person, let me quickly move to a more international perspective and just come back to the slide so we can imagine all these countries that we're dealing with. And it's, if you think back to 2015 and the Paris Agreement, the political alignments that made that agreement possible. We had the US and China come together a year before and do a crucial deal after literally hundreds of meetings between them to see whether they could both step up. We had India in a reasonably good place. We had great leadership from Europe, including really significant leadership from the UK, and we had a disproportionate influence from the small island states, or large ocean states, as I think they should be probably renamed. And Africa was behind this. We had a grouping around 2015 that could get the Paris Agreement done, agree to decarbonize the world by the middle of the century or thereabouts. At the last COP, we just about held it together and got the rule book, the rules of the road to implement the Paris Agreement done in December. But 5 years on from Paris in 2020, there will be COP26, at which countries have to come to the table and say, we did a lot towards this 2050 commitment, We kept ourselves on track and give ourselves a shot of meeting these temperature rise limits. And we commit to go further, far enough to make sure that we stay on, or get closer to being on track and deliver what we need to deliver. So 2020 is a really, really big year. And by the way, it comes in a year when we've also got the review of the Sustainable Development Goals. We've also got the Convention on Biodiversity, chaired by China in Beijing. So there's a triumvirate of really critical events that we need to make sure are mutually reinforcing. But I was talking about the coalition that we had ahead of Paris, and then how we only just got that deal over the line. Look at the political situation now. We all know where the US is at federal level, at least. Some remarkable things happening, particularly in the innovation and national labs and science and university space in the US and at the state level, and we're still in and all of that. Fantastic and crucial. But at the federal level, we know where we are. We've got the Brazil situation worsening. We've got probably, if anything, a hardening of the Russia position. We've got fantastic things happening in China and India. India is putting in, well, it was pledging to put in 160 gigawatts, so double the UK capacity in 4 years. And then it said, no, we can't do 160. We're going to do 225. And it's on track. So India's done remarkable things, particularly in wind, but also in solar. China is leading the world on wind and solar, but there are also lots of other things going on. And the Belt and Road Initiative is one area where there are a lot of coal investments going in around the world, funded by the Belt and Road Initiative, that are not compatible with meeting these goals. So the alignments are really nowhere near where we need to be, particularly given how off track we are. And I think about who's okay in this space at the moment. Europe remains, you know, pretty focused and pretty good on its ambition. The small island states, we've held numerous meetings, particularly with the Pacific Islands, who are really feeling this already as existential. Mexico, Colombia, are very encouraging and staying the course. But it's a little more mixed picture. Japan, very under-ambitious so far. Korea, a lot of coal, trying to move out of it, you know, preoccupied by the very, very difficult and important issues around nuclear. Canada, you know, doing great things, including with partnering with us on coal, but, you know, challenging with the oil sands and so forth. China, India, Indonesia, South Africa have not taken that potential leadership role of a major emerging market and stepped up and said this is identifiably something we're going to lead on. In a harder place still, across Africa, a lack of capacity, a lack of focus, but an enormous opportunity given the integration and the mutual benefit of development, resilience, and climate action and economic development. And then I mentioned, you know, Brazil, US, Russia, and Australia, you know, in a worrying place at the federal level. So we have nothing like the coalitions we need. The next 18 months are critical to build those kind of alignments. And the upside of that, I think, is that what's changed critically is the pricing. So we did Paris in a world where we said we have to do this, and we have to bring costs down, we have to make it possible, but it will cost a hell of a lot of money. It will still cost a lot of money to do this transition, but we now know, I mentioned the unit cost of offshore wind, we now know that the economics has fundamentally changed and the lines have crossed, and there's almost nowhere where doing it cleanly is less profitable than doing it in a dirty way. So we have to get that message out across our society, across our system, that the clean and green route, as I alluded to in the earlier slides, is the only route. It just involves an extraordinary level of disruption and change in an extraordinarily narrow period of time, if you think about how long we've been working on this. But the real economy is a place where, if you think, can China come to the 2020 COP and raise its ambition? Can India? Those ambition levels were relatively modest in 2015. There is a lot of upside, and it's critical that the business community leads as well and shows how big that upside is, and shows how, in a sense, the negotiators are lagging the real economy. And this is something that we want to do, and we need to hear from the business and others. What are the policy and regulatory signals they need to really take a quantum of change in this area? While I was talking about business, just a point about disruption and incumbents and pace. I don't want to single out a particular sector, but this slide is quite striking. Oil and gas investments in low carbon as a proportion of total capital over an 8-year period. Particularly looking at the Russian, Chinese, Italian, Russia, Brazilian, Indian companies, less than 0.2% going into that whole swathe of lower carbon investments. So all the rest is going into traditional fossil investments, right at the point in time when we have to get out of all of it, all those investments that have 40, 50-year timelines. So it's just one example of just how disruptive this process is going to have to be as we move forward, and how the answers are going to come from both those currently in the market, but from an extraordinary number of new players doing things very, very differently, disintermediating and disrupting. So as the father of two young twins, I'll finish with a couple of cartoons from their nighttime reading. Can we deliver the Paris Agreement? I'm essentially saying yes, but it is an extraordinary, extraordinary challenge with very little time and a system-wide change. And Jim Ski did a phenomenal job in describing it, doing the work, but then I thought describing it as an unprecedented shift across the whole of society in a very short period of time. And I do think this sort of speaks to, you know, for those who can't read it, here comes Edward Bear, my personal favourite. I always try to read, they don't want to read him, but I make them listen. Edward Bear comes down the stairs, bump, 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 on the back of his head. It is, as far as he knows, the only way of coming down those stairs. He's sure there must be a better way. If only he could stop bumping for a moment and think of it. And I think that stepping back and recognising exactly what we're talking about and doing things differently is going to be vital. And Dr. Seuss is the other favourite. Again, not one they're particularly keen on, but I force it down them every night. The Lorax, unless someone like you cares a whole awful lot, nothing's going to get better. It's not. So that's my sort of challenge, my leadership challenge to all of you. Everybody has to see this as their business. The critical thing I think we found with the pricing point that I made is that this has shifted decisively from an environmental or climate issue. That was always just the symptom, the impact, to a mainstream economic and political challenge of our era that we will not tackle by simply talking about climate change, but talking about health, air quality, quality of life, livable cities, biodiversity protection, species protection, clean water, all of those things. And I finish by saying that the civil society community did such a phenomenal job in the 2008 Climate Change Act by kicking off that campaign. Business, who under the CBI label brought forward a very influential report which helped us get through the Climate Change Act in 2008. And government, who needs to set the regulatory and policy frameworks both in countries and across the world, all of these constituencies, and also bringing in every community in the world, we have to find a way of having multiple narratives that are mutually reinforcing and can tackle the scale of the problem that we face. But yes, it is possible. Thank you.